On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
If you are a big Bob Dylan fan, you will recognise not only, of course, that song, but you'll recognise the significance of the performance that that is, because today is one of the most important musical anniversaries in 20th century history. And it's not a birthday, but rather it is the anniversary of the day in which that performance at Newport Folk Festival occurred in 1965. It is the day, July the 28th, in which Bob Dylan went electric. Some people were horrified by what they saw on that stage in 1965. A few months later, he visited Ireland. It was a tour that saw Bob Dylan booed and jeered by some. And it would nearly be two decades before Bob Dylan then returned to these shores. And Donald Fallon has been going through his back catalogue of 78s and RPMs and all of his finest pre-MP3 Dylan collections to tell us all about it. Of course, Bob Dylan held in such high esteem here that when he had his 80th birthday not too long ago, he got a letter from Michael Dee.
Absolutely. His recent 80th birthday was marked by another 80-year-old poet, you know, none other than President Michael Dee Higgins. And it was a brilliant assessment of Bob Dylan by Ireland's favourite sociologist. He told Dylan, "In 2016, I said of you, Bob Dylan's linking of the American folk tradition to moral, economic and political challenges has been a significant achievement, and the appeal of his music has been intergenerational. His lyrics with their rhythms have linked followers of country, jazz and rock to countercultural and politically engaged movements. In doing this, he has narrowed the space between the poetic, the musical and the political. My opinion hasn't changed." Isn't that just Michael Dee?
It's handy that Michael Dee can just kind of quote something he wrote 4 or 5 years previous and just go, "I still believe that. That's fine." Yeah.
Well, you know, when Dylan first came to Ireland in the 1960s, the view of him was very, very different from what we just heard from Michael Dee Higgins. A lot of people felt in the 60s that the political Bob Dylan had been buried. You know, at a time when there was such protest in the world and, you know, wars being fought on so many continents, many people felt like their folk hero, you know, had gone with it. And it's difficult for us at the remove of a half century now to understand the level of anger Dylan denounced as a Judas, you know, at one concert on this famous tour.
And it is trying to distill and understand some of that anger that we're going to talk about today. Probably is worth remembering, just by way of setting the context for how big the transformation was, that Bob Dylan was, not only was he very young, but he was also a very, very traditional folk singer when he first appeared on the world stage.
What a great name, Robert Allen Zimmerman. He bursts onto the world stage in 62 as Bob Dylan. But I think it's the following year, that great album, The Freewheeling Bob Dylan, that kind of propels him to new heights of stardom. And, you know, he was a singer for his time. When you read the lyrics to something like The Times They Are Changing, it captures an America that really hadn't come to ease with itself, you know, politically and socially. And he wore his influences very openly and very proudly. I think above all else, he was a disciple of the great Woody Guthrie. And he actually seeks out an ailing Woody Guthrie. I just find this mental image beautiful. A 20-year-old Bob Dylan visits Woody Guthrie and sings Woody Guthrie songs to him on the guitar. So he's in that tradition. He's in the tradition of Guthrie and that great American political folk tradition.
Yeah, not so much the American, but we certainly have a political folk tradition in our own country as well, because it had a massive influence on Bob Dylan, particularly the work of the Clancys.
He's greatly influenced by the Clancy brothers, who are kind of hanging around Greenwich Village and who have taken America by storm. I mean, they've been on the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, we all think about how they looked, the Aaron Jumpers and all of that, but how did they sound? Yeah. That's what really turned
I didn't know that they'd been in the Ed Sullivan Show, and you just associate that with Elvis's hip thrusting or the Beatles' breakthrough performance or something. You'd never think that our own lads were of the same kind of platform.
The level of stardom that, you know, Liam Clancy's Aaron Jumper belonged on the same stage as a gyrating Elvis. But, you know, in time, he greatly surpassed the Clancy brothers, of course, and Tommy Makem as a commercial success. But Bob Dylan never forgot them. There's a lovely quote in the 80s. He says, "I never heard a singer as good as Liam Clancy ever. He was the best ballad singer I'd ever heard in my life, and he still is, probably." And you can hear that influence in some of those early Dylan records. The songs are kind of inspired by the airs of Irish traditional and folk music. Not everyone liked that, by the way. Dominic Behan, the songwriter, thought that one Dylan song was a little bit too close to home, to one of his own. But in Dylan's defence, that's how it goes in folk music. Songs are not so much created as they're reborn. But this young Dylan is obsessed with Ireland and all things Irish. He tries to hunt down Brendan Behan when he's in New York City in 1962. He doesn't meet him. There's a great account of it. Bob followed him to the White Horse hoping for a conversation, but Behan was in no shape for anything remotely resembling talk and eventually passed out. And Dave Hannigan...
Sorry, I wasn't expecting that sort of gravitas for how the night ended. Sorry.
Dave Hannigan is a great writer on all things Irish-American. Fantastic writer, fantastic sports writer too. He's a great quote from Brendan. He said, "Folk singers I personally detest. I would shoot every one of them." So maybe it was just as well for Bob Dylan that he didn't get to meet Brendan in the end.
Just better having a bit too much of the black stuff and maybe just taking an early night. By the mid-1960s, and it's remarkable even when you say this out loud, because we talk about the freewheeling Bob Dylan in 1963 being the one that really catapults him to the global stage. And we're only talking 2 years later, but already Dylan was very keen to get away from the kind of sound that he built his early career on. But moreover, he wasn't making any secret of it.
Absolutely. I think this happens to everyone. You know, it happened to the Beatles. It happened to One Direction. Eventually, people want to move.
Wow. that's a comparison no one has ever drawn in the history of popular music.
When you make your career on a certain sound.
It's the one thing that the Beatles and the BTS have in common. Like, wow. Wow.
There comes a time when you want to do something different. And by 1965, Dylan is moving in a very, very different direction musically. And it doesn't happen overnight. I think when you read the lyrics to some of his songs, you see it. My Back Pages, which I think is one of Dylan's best songs, talks of becoming his own enemy in the instant that I preach. And then this great refrain, one of the greatest refrains of musical history. I'm so much older now. I'm younger than that now. I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. So Dylan is kind of questioning himself as a folk protest singer. And he's wondering, is there another path ahead for me? And it's not just that Bob Dylan decides to go electric and to move away from the kind of folk protest tradition. It's where he does it. He goes to the Newport Folk Festival on this day in 1965. The folk festival is organised by Alan Lomax, who's, you know, a god of folk music. He's a collector of songs and music, unlike any other in the world. He'd actually come on several trips to Ireland recording Irish traditional music. But Lomax is someone who's really serious about folk music, how you play it, how you learn it, the purity of it. And when Dylan arrives on stage with this kind of hastily assembled band, one reviewer beautifully says that he electrified one half of the audience and electrocuted the other.
Well, we played you a little bit of his performance of Like a Rolling Stone in the opening, and I'm going to rewind back the track, and I'm going to play you a version which you can still find online. Before the track actually gets going, you can hear the reaction of the crowd when they see what's about to happen and exactly what Bob Dylan has in his hands. And you can tell from what you're about to hear that the crowd is not best pleased about what they're seeing unfold. So you can tell that there's half the crowd there who are like, yeah, it's Bob Dylan on stage. This is brilliant. We're in Wales and Bob Dylan is here. And the other half are like, this is sacrilege now. This is not what we came for at all, at all, at all. And some real folk music luminaries had very different views on what he did. But, there, you know, it was worth saying that there was some really, really profound condemnation of what he'd done.
I like how Joan Baez remembers it. She says that by today's standards, the volume wasn't particularly high. But in 1965, it was probably the loudest thing anyone in the audience had ever heard. A buzz of shock and amazement ran through the crowd. Some people loved it, and that is worth saying. I mean, I think this event is remembered as everyone booed. A lot of people booed. Some people absolutely loved it. But a new Dylan was born. And I think to have done that in the setting where he did it wasn't going to win him a lot of friends. I mean, the harshest words came from Ewan McCall, the father of Kirsty McCall, also the father of the British folk revival, which was then in full swing. He said, "Our traditional songs and ballads are the creations of extraordinary talented artists working inside disciplines formulated over time. But what about Bobby Dylan?" screamed the outraged teenagers. Only a completely non-critical audience, nourished on the watery pap of pop music, could have fallen for such tent-rate drivel. That is extraordinary stuff. Ewan McCall, by the way, never listened to his daughter Kirsty McCall's records because they were pop music. Like, he was really adamant about how folk music should be performed, and a real purist.
I suppose at least he's consistent in his purity then, because that's... It's puritanical to say the least. But look, he's entitled to think that Dylan is a bit of a betrayal at this point. Dylan comes to Ireland in 1966. And at that point, it's a country that's going through its own folk music revival. And there's a lot of new voices coming through at that
stage. That's what's so interesting to me about this Bob Dylan story, how tied in it is to what's happening in Ireland. Ireland is one of the epicentres of this global folk revival that's happening. The Dubliners, you know, are at the height of their own stardom, very much nurtured by Ewan McCall. And Dublin has a really, really thriving folk scene of its own. Just like in the United States, it's this weird balance of kind of traditional craft and new emerging voices. So if you walk through the Dublin that Dylan visits in the 60s, you know, Slattery's, Taylor's Hall, the Embankment, there's just music everywhere. There's so much happening in folk music. And I think for a lot of those young people, those kind of you know, young bearded folkies, Dylan was the kind of gateway drug, if you will, that got them into folk music. So when Dylan is coming to Ireland, they want a certain kind of Bob Dylan. And unfortunately for a Dublin audience in 1966, that's not the Dylan that's on offer anymore.
And we can even hear some booing and jeering in some of the surviving footage from that first gig in Ireland.
Which is amazing. It's the Adelphi. I mean, the Adelphi has a plaque up where it was for the Beatles.
Yeah.
The only Irish performances for the Beatles happened in the Adelphi. But the surviving recordings of that gig are quite amazing. Someone shouts at him in a Dublin accent, "Traitor! You know, traitor." And Dylan does this trick, and this is his way of getting back at the crowd. He does it across this tour. Before every song, he tells them, "This next song is a folk song," and they all clap.
Yeah.
And then the electric guitars come in, and he just refuses to give the audience what they want. So in the Adelphi's history, you know, the fact that the Beatles went there is this great moment that celebrated. Gay Byrne actually unveiled the plaque, but the visit of Dylan is something that is by no way as fondly remembered.
The surviving reviews of that show, despite how critical and how divisive it was, the reviews themselves actually aren't all that bad.
Yeah, some people talk about the entertainment value of it, and they ponder, you know, is there much to Dylan beyond being entertaining? George Desmond Hodnett, or Hoddy as he was known, wrote for the Irish Times, was pretty cutting though. He said that Mr. Dylan is a poet, and though he might be but a minor one, were he to publish in slim volumes without the assistance of guitar, harmonica and publicity machine, it is something to sell poetry to a mass audience at all. Now, that's pretty cutting in its own way. You know, there's some good lines here, but this guy's not a real poet. But Dylan then goes to Belfast after playing the Adelphi in Dublin. He plays the ABC Theatre. And for whatever reason, the reception in Belfast is really good. And it might be that maybe, you know, the folk revival was so centred on Dublin. Belfast was always more open musically. I mean, Rory Gallagher, they fell in love with him there. I think Belfast as a city was just more open, perhaps, to this kind of electronic...
Is there a little bit more of a British influence, maybe culturally speaking, that they're a little bit more okay with the idea of electric guitars all over the place?
Whatever it was, they loved them in Belfast and jeered them in Dublin. But when he gets to Manchester a few weeks later, that's where the famous jeer happens. A heckler stands up and shouts, "Judas!" And Dylan replies brilliantly, "I don't believe you."
What a poet. Dylan's musical journey in the end, probably fair to say that although this was a very experimental and a very divisive phase, it does lose him some admirers, but he probably does, almost as a crossover artist, he gains a whole lot more.
Yeah, Bob Dylan loses the bearded folkies in 1965 and 66, but he gains legions of new young fans. And I think that leap that he made to electronic music, we now recognise that as one of the most ambitious and important developments, I think, in 20th century music history. And eventually, I think Dylan found the point where the folk music and the electronic guitar music you know, could coexist side by side. He doesn't come back to Ireland until Slane, 1984. An incredible gig. Produces many, many happy memories for a generation of Irish music fans, and gives us, to tie this back to the beginning, a really iconic image of a beaming Michael D. Higgins.
Yes,
sandals, double denim, open shirt. It's just an incredible picture. Yeah. One of my favourite images of Michael D. And you know, he left us waiting 20 years, but he's come back many, many times since.
He was rocking the double denim a good 15 years before Bewitched even tried it. That's how much of a trailblazer Michael D. is. You were in Croke Park last weekend. If there's anyone still in the car who's driving up this afternoon for the Connacht final in Croke Park, people who might be unused to Croke Park at this time of year, any advice for them?
It's an unusual experience. And I would tell people, it's an oddly emotional experience. You know, I think people are finding this in general. Going back to the little things that we always did is really nice. So it may not have been Hill 16, but it was still a really nice experience.
I don't want to be too mean, but it might be a good opportunity for Mayo to get used to lifting silverware in Croke Park.
Yes,
you never know what way the year is going to go, because your boys were looking fairly frail against my mighty Royals last week. Donald Fallon, author of the Come Here to Me book and of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, thank you very much as ever. Donald's podcast, Three Castles Burning, about Dublin history, is available anywhere you get your audio online.